This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
By the book on BFM 89.9.
Hello, you are listening to By the Book. I'm Sharmila Ganesan, and as always, my fellow worrywart but also comforter in times of need and difficulty, Lee Tri Lin.
Hello, worrywart is very accurate indeed.
I think not just for you and me, but for a lot of people. Every time I speak to someone, when we ask each other, how are you doing, which in itself is new to foreground asking how someone is doing, the answer I always get is, I'm okay, but there's like an underlying feeling of anxiety or worry. And so that's actually what our show today is about. Books that maybe either directly deal with the idea of worrying or anxiety or even grief, or books that help you work through those issues in some way or the other.
Yeah, and I think a lot of books actually do this, right? Because we've talked about this before. Happiness just isn't all that interesting in a literary sense. More often than not, you want conflict or anger or sadness or something. You know, that's the impetus for the story itself. But I think what we've got going today, and we should say up front that Sharmila and I are in very different spaces. It's odd, but we are actually reading things very, very differently, and mm-hmm. we are attracted to different types of things at this point in time. Is that fair to say? Because I feel as if whenever we check in on each other on what we've been reading, the answers tend to be quite opposite to one another.
No, I agree. And it's something I've been wondering about myself, because I know you've actually been diving in quite deep and finding a lot of comfort in reading. For me, it's been a lot more sporadic. And the things that I pick tend to either be things that I'm already deeply familiar with, so very comfortable reads that I can stop reading and not feel guilty about. Or they tend to be things like graphic novels or articles or short stories, you know, things that I don't know, that maybe require less from me. And I think that's just the space I've been in. I've also been watching a lot of things that I haven't had time to watch before. So that might partly be it. We've talked a lot about how screens tend to take you away from books. And I do find that's a little bit the case right now. But I also think sometimes I just don't have the mental energy to sink into like substantive pieces of work.
Yeah, reading for me has been a real balm, actually. It has gone back to how I used to feel when I was a teenager or when I was younger, and I just read book after book after book, simply because it's what I want. Like you, I find myself drawn to screens, and the first time I picked up a book after a prolonged period of just being on the screen, watching thing after thing, looking at meaningless scrolls of whatever, I felt my brain just quieten down. And I think I've been searching for that feeling ever since, which is why I kind of wanted to talk about this, how books can help or how books can address or deal with this issue of worry and anxiety and fear.
Mm. Well, I think you should start us off, because I think the initial book that sparked this idea for you is a really, really good example of exactly what you're talking about.
Sure. So I recently read Ali Smith's How to Be Both.
How to Be Both is a novel which is a kind of dual novel. It is made of two sections which swap round, depending which one you pick up off the shelf. And within that, it's a story in which history and the contemporary meet and meld in a way which makes, with any luck, a layered whole. Based on fresco, you can peel the plaster off the wall, peel the, as it were, the skin off the wall, under which there's an unsaid or an unseen but felt story. It's about what it means to live in the contemporary world and then suddenly just sense in a plum moment the drop away of history beneath us.
It is fantastic. I don't know how much or how little I should say, except that it is a book of two literal halves. It tells two different stories. One of a girl mourning the loss of her mother, Georgia, or George. The book also plays a lot with the ideas of gender and fluidity in that way. And on the other side of it, a Renaissance artist who is making a piece of art that George and her mother are going to be very, very drawn to in their own timeline, in their own space. And so they aren't, it's not told in a chapter by chapter way. When I was first introduced to the book, I thought that it was going to be one chapter here, one chapter there, and so on, in the way of something like Game of Thrones, for example. But it's not that. It is actually split right into half. So first you read, you can choose to do it either way, and both, whether you read the second story first or the first story first, whatever, however it is that you choose to do it, you will still get a sense of these two stories informing one another about death and art and the wonder of being seen and of revisiting something to truly see it for the first, second, fifth time, about the marvel it is to be seen and noticed in this world. And for a book that grapples with that and that grapples with death very, very fundamentally, it was such a delightful read. I completely lost myself in it. I just wanted to know what was going to happen. The language is so witty and smart and poetic, but also very simple. And it is just one of the best books I've read this year, and I really enjoyed it.
So I first heard about How to Be Both, I think a couple of years ago, when the book came out and it was nominated for a Booker. Mm. And the story really, really appealed to me. I mean, everything about it is right up my alley, the whole connection to the art. I love stories that are sort of, that are stories within stories, or kind of divide up the narrative in some, you know, unique way. For me, though, I always find it very difficult to immediately pick up books that are about grief, that are about especially parents passing on. And so that was kind of what kept me away from it at that point. I still haven't read it. Although, you know, Ali Smith is one of those writers that I feel like I've read excerpts and I've always wanted to, and this would have been a great entry point. You make a good case for it. Maybe not at this time. This has been a particularly weepy week for me. Like everything, everything makes me want to sort of like burst out into tears. So maybe not this week, but you kind of make me feel like I can do it.
I would say that as somebody who enjoys art, and for how I feel about this book is that I felt about it the way I would feel standing in front of a work of art and being overwhelmed by it, whether that's positive or negative. And I think that's for you to process later, right? You know, normally when you go to a gallery and you see something, it has to be visceral. I think the connection to art should be at its best visceral. And that's how I felt about this book. I just felt overwhelmed and kind of in love and infatuated with it. And I'm still processing it. And that's kind of why I wanted to talk about it. So for a book that is about art and grief, the experience of it was similarly overwhelming. I really liked it.
Okay. Well, excuse me. My book is something of a very different animal, I think. But for me, when I read it a few years ago, something equally, it left a huge mark on me. And I think it's not a book that many people, or as many people as I think should have read it, did. And that's Memoirs of an Imaginary Friend by Matthew Green. It came out in 2012, and it's sort of set in that same mold as things like Room by Emma Donoghue, or A Curious Incident of Dog in the Nighttime, where sort of these big, big events are told through the lens of a naive narrator almost, right? But this book is delightful in many, many ways. It's literally the memoir of an imaginary friend. So it's told from the perspective of the imaginary friend. And the premise of the novel is that there's this boy. The book never explains it, but he does seem to be special needs somehow. And because of that, he's 8, but his imaginary friend is still hanging around, whereas a lot of other kids his age have kind of left them behind. And so the imaginary friend, whose name is Budo, sort of has seen many other imaginary friends come and go. So the premise of the book is that the imaginary friends can talk to each other, but they can only talk to their own human. And so what happens is he's seen every other imaginary friend he knows die. And he knows that at some point when the child decides he doesn't believe in these things anymore, he too will die.
It's a Tinkerbell situation.
You know, yes, definitely. But then it comes to a situation where essentially the imaginary, so Budo can help his human out of a dangerous, almost, you know, permanently life-changing situation. But it would mean that it would risk his existence. I'm not going to get into why, but it, and so the second half of the book really kind of reads like a suspense thriller, because you're kind of thinking, well, is he going to save him and then therefore negate himself, or is he going to? And so this, when we talked about anxiety and worry and grief, this book is suffused with it. It's just existential fear, but really there's so many pockets of delight, because it makes you think about when you were a child and how I used to have an imaginary friend. And, you know, this idea of how the things we leave behind and how they define us. And so much packed into what I think is maybe a rather twee concept, if you just sort of read it divorced from the entire novel, but really a very, very powerful read. And yeah, it's also a book that I find difficult to revisit. So I've only ever read it that one time, but it always comes to mind when I think about books on I think just the anxiety of life.
I used to tell people I had an imaginary friend so I could make up stories about the imaginary friend, but I didn't have one.
Oh, bless you.
I've never said that out loud before. But what I wanted to know was, in terms of the tone of the book or the language of it, so I have to be honest, your reference points for the other two books, Room as well as The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, I read both. But I read both mostly because I was told they were important books. And they had emotional impact and all that. But I struggled through the read because of the naive narrator. I found it difficult reading that kind of language, that kind of processing. And I found the same was true for The Diaries of Adrian Mole, for example, where you're like, oh my gosh, I don't know if I like spending time with you. So in terms of the language or tone of this book, does it match up with that as well?
So I like Curious Incident more than I like Room, for instance, in terms of that tone. And I think, I don't know if you're talking about the same thing, that for me, what gets to me is this sort of the author playing down themselves to sound like this character, which I
like
don't
a child,
like. Yeah, like a child. And it sort of grates on you. This book somehow doesn't feel that way. And I think it might be because the imaginary friend is not necessarily a child. He is more of a sort of a creature of its own being, and it lives in a specific world. So I think in that sense, the author made quite a smart decision, because it's not the child himself narrating the story. It's a being that kind of understands the human world, but isn't really part of the human world. And so for me, also someone who's inclined to fantasy and stuff like that, so that kind of worked more than I think if I had truly been reading a child narrating the book.
Nice. So yeah. We have two recommendations so far. They are Ali Smith's How to Be Both
and Memoirs of an Imaginary Friend by Matthew Green. So if you have books that you would like to recommend or share with us, because they help you get through your moments of grief or worry or anxiety, or if because they do in fact talk about those things, let us know. You can tweet us at BFM Radio. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Or you can write to us at buythebook@bfm.my.
Be free-minded. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back. You're listening to By the Book with me, Sharmila, and Lynn. So today we are talking about books that address ideas or themes of, the big sort of emotional arcs, I suppose, worry, anxiety, grief.
Gosh, I wonder why.
Because nothing else is happening in the world that might make us feel that way. And I think that books really do tend to be, for readers particularly, a way in which we can process those emotions. So before the break, we talked about How to Be Both by Ali Smith and Memoirs of an Imaginary Friend by Matthew Green. What do you have next, Lynn?
Well, I'm going to talk about an actual memoir, and that was one written by Julian Barnes, and it's called Nothing to be Frightened Of. And it is, well, the cover is a gravesite. I will just say that. The cover
That's
is,
where we're starting.
Yes, the cover is sort of this illustrated 6-foot hole, and then the title is like superimposed on that. Anyway, so that tells you what the book is about, and it is about death. It's about a self-confessed agnostic atheist who is now at the age of 62, I believe he was, grappling with this idea that it is now closer to him than ever before. And have you read Julian Barnes?
I've read The Sense of an Ending.
Yes. Mm. So if you've read any Julian Barnes, you will know what his tone of voice is. He's a very, what's the word? I think he's quite a refined writer.
Yeah.
But there is, and there's a lot of emotion, but it's also very sublimated. He's very English. So yeah. That tells you the general tone of this book. And it explores his fear of death. It explores really his obsession with the idea of dying and with leaving nothing behind and with wanting something to hold on to, but being unable to find that in spirituality. You know, he wasn't raised in any sort of religion at all. So I think for him, the idea of suddenly just going, yep, okay, now's the time. You know, he just couldn't bring himself to do that. And also he writes very movingly about being moved. I think in the same way that when any of us think about the enormity that is death, we also think about the enormity that is life, you know, and how much and how little we can love and enjoy the small things. And this is a book that rejoices in that sort of detail, even as it explores his ideas of what it means to die, of seeing his parents through their respective deaths. So I think it is a book that people have enjoyed, and that has also been criticized for the remove, for the fact that he is slightly removed from the topic that he's talking about. But I think in this case, it's actually a benefit. It's actually an advantage because it's too much. It is too much, guys. So at a point, I think, where we're trying to, maybe not all of us are thinking about death, you know what? Maybe it's just me, I don't know. But at a point where we're thinking about these things, or if you are somebody who worries about this sort of thing, I think having somebody intellectualize it for you, but also drop into pockets of sentimentality, at least for me, was just what I wanted.
Mm. I'm just thinking of the sense of an ending and that sort of, you're right, that aloofness is not the word, but, you know, it's more about friendships there and sort of that assumption, almost in the way the fox and the hound does. I know it's a weird sort of comparison, but the limitations of what you think are lifelong friendships and the way in which they evolve and the growing up within a relationship in some ways. I can imagine that he would actually be really good at writing about something like the end of life, or ruminating on it without getting, and I get what you mean, because and that's actually why I often stay away from books like this, because sometimes they get too much. They're too much. They take too much out of me to read them. And I think a little bit of a distance sometimes may not be the worst thing.
Yeah, and he wrote this actually before his wife passed away. So that's just an interesting sort of added thing. Sorry, guys, I'm being a bit of a downer, but I really enjoyed this book. It's an extremely elegant read, and it dives deep into something that I think a lot of us think about but might not always verbalize. So it's nice reading someone else who has these thoughts. And that is Julian Barnes' Nothing to be Frightened of.
Well, I'm going to pick something really quite different from that.
We are on opposite ends today.
We are. But that's, you know, just the kind of show this is, and it's for every kind of reader.
Yeah.
this was a bit of a self-pleasing choice, but also because, I'm just going to say it. My choice is the Artemis Fowl series by Owen Colfer.
How does one describe Artemis Fowl? Various psychiatrists have tried and failed. The main problem is Artemis's own intelligence. He bamboozles every test thrown at him. He has puzzled the greatest medical minds and sent many of them gibbering to their own hospitals. There is no doubt that Artemis is a child prodigy. But why does someone of such brilliance dedicate himself to criminal activities? This is a question that can be answered by only one person, and he delights in not talking. Perhaps the best way to create an accurate picture of Artemis is to tell the by now famous account of his first villainous venture.
If you are not aware of the series, it came out just after sort of that Harry Potter craze, but does something very different. It is about a teenage boy who's just coming into his teenagehood. This is instead about fairies, and it's about, so he's a genius. He comes from a very wealthy Irish family. The series has 8 books, and in the first book, he basically discovers that there's this underworld of super advanced, technologically superior fairy race. And the whole plot begins with him wanting to kidnap one of them so that he can hold them for ransom. Now, On the surface, people may really have no idea why I've picked that series for this topic, but because the entire series, so it, essentially the reason he does this is because his father has been, his father is in some really bad trouble and they need money. I'm trying not to give away what happens. And this is actually a theme that gets repeated throughout the series. So the underlying tension for most of the adventures that he goes on, for most of the... for the coldness that he builds around himself, because at the start of the book, he's a supervillain. And over the course of the series, he kind of evolves into becoming a proper little boy. And the reason that he wraps himself in this coldness, in this shell, and uses his intelligence rather than his emotions is because he's deeply, deeply worried about his family. His mom has essentially cloistered herself and refuses to come out and refuses to live in the real world. He has no one but the butler, his bodyguard, whose name is Butler, to be his parental figure. But he's also his employer. So there's this weird dynamic there. And then he finds that the people he's closest to now are the very people that he has decided to hunt down, which are the fairy folk. So it doesn't sort of wear those emotions very, very obviously on its sleeve. But I love how Owen Colfer uses this dynamic to explore what it's like for a child that's surrounded by very, very adult issues and has to grapple with the idea that you might lose a parent, your parent might have mental health issues, people that you really look up to may not be around forever, your best friend may end up not being around when you need them. You know, some really big questions explored through this beautifully realized world, young adult series, but very, very powerfully written. I love Owen Colfer as a writer. I think most of his books explore these big issues through very relatable lenses. And I think that the Artemis Fowl series is, for good reason, definitely his masterpiece.
So, you know, the thing about this is, so I haven't read Artemis Fowl, because I think I was misled by the cover of the book and the way it looks, because after you've gone through Harry Potter, like you said, right, if it comes out around the same time, it's very, very unfortunate, but that tends to be what happens with books. You have this like one meteoric crazy thing and then everybody else just looks like they're following in its wake, even though that might not be fair. And the thing about this that comes to mind for me, at least, is children's books, YA books, really not for the faint of heart. I think people tend to make assumptions about them because of who they say the target audience is for, and for all the same reasons that people dismiss fantasy, because it doesn't take place in the real, quote-unquote, real world, so it can't possibly be grappling with whatever real issues it is that we want it to be. But the truth of the matter is, listening to what you just said, listening to what you just described, and thinking about a number of other YA books that also explore a central hero who's trying to work through issues of grief and having to overcome deaths and setbacks, they are not what the cover would indicate.
No, I think the Artemis Fowl books, like you said, were done a bit of a disservice because they were marketed in the same vein as Harry Potter. And that's not to say Harry Potter also doesn't deal with huge issues, which we've talked about in other shows. But yeah, collectively, I think they get a short shrift when it comes to how capably they handle these issues. And in some ways, you know, like in comparison to what we talked about earlier, better than some adult books that try to kind of deal with them and maybe often come off sounding patronizing or whatever. So those are our second group of suggestions. Mine was the Artemis Fowl series, 8 books by Owen Colfer and Lynn's.
Julian Barnes's Nothing to be Frightened Of.
So those round up our discussion, I suppose, on books that deal with themes of grief or worry or anxiety, particularly at a time when many of us might be going through versions of those in our own way. You can tweet us or let us know what you've been reading, if they've been helping you get through your own, emotional ups and downs. You can tweet us at BFM Radio. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Or write to us at buythebook@bfm.my. And that brings us to footnotes. And because the last time Lynn and I really enjoyed this little segment, this sort of permutation of the segment where we shared articles that we've been reading. And I also think just because we have more time to read these long articles, we thought we'd revisit that and share another two articles that maybe made an impact on us in the last couple of weeks. Lynn, do you want to go first?
Sure. So mine is called My Restaurant Was My Life for 20 Years, Does the World Need It Anymore? And it was written by Gabrielle Hamilton. It is published on the New York Times, where Gabrielle Hamilton is a contributing writer, recipe writer, and so on. And she, of course, is the chef and owner of Prune, which is a restaurant in New York. She is also the author of a memoir, Blood, Bones, and Butter, which was a book that I think Anthony Bourdain said that if it had come out before Kitchen Confidential, he wouldn't have had a career. So she's that kind of writer. She's quite direct and brutal in some ways about her descriptions. And this was a very moving piece because her restaurant was small but influential. It sat in a neighborhood that she saw through years of gentrification and diversification in terms of cafes and restaurants and the food scene. And the article itself is both a very nuts and bolts look at what it means to close a restaurant, the fact that you have to clean it. What are you going to do about your supplies? How are you going to pay people back? How are you going to tell people that they don't have a job anymore? But it's also a meditation on what the restaurant has meant to her for 20 years, and also what it's meant to the city, and also whether or not people still want it, or what does she imagine being able to, or what does she imagine contributing to the new normal once it is done, once it happens? And it's moving and beautiful and just really well done. I think at a time where we're seeing lots and lots of changes in our personal lives, in industries, across the board, it was interesting and beautiful just to have that insight into what happens to someone's life when something that has consumed, you know, half of it goes away for a while.
This was a beautiful article. I read it independent of you recommending it. And I think if you hadn't picked it, I might have picked it. And it also reminded me of the article that I picked for our last discussion, which kind of talks about an industry and its place within this world now. And, you know, these are often like the food scene. It's especially the fine dining scene or the restaurant scene. Is it important? Who cares, really? You know, like that kind of emotion really, really, you know, plays through this article in a way that I found very, it was a very difficult read and made me feel sad. It made me feel both sad for a world that she had built and for the world that it ultimately became, because she also uses it to critique the changing food scene and how, yes, coronavirus might have been the final nail in the coffin, but that the whole restaurant scene and the snobbery that surrounds it and the pageantry that surrounds it had already brought it to its own kind of demise for a lot of people. Not everyone shut down because of the virus.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, spoiler alert, she wasn't earning much money. You know, for someone who owns a fine dining restaurant, wasn't making that much money from it. So, or I think she was barely breaking even. So anyway, it's a fantastic read. It's very, very good. And it's in the New York Times. It's by Gabrielle Hamilton. It's called My Restaurant Was My Life for 20 Years. Does the World Need It Anymore?
Mine is completely different.
And great.
I honestly must tell you, the reason I started reading it was the title, which was How Conquering the Disney Cosplay Universe Helped Me Finally Love My Body. And it's by Tabitha Blankenbiller, and it's on narratively.com. I often turn to Narratively because they just have this wonderful mixed bag of long reads, you know, and you can read them by topic. You can filter and really... so much to read there. And if you want, you can donate as well. But the reason this article spoke to me was because, one, it's I think it's really an experience that a lot of kids, particularly girls who grow up not being that typical, you know, cute or slim or any of those, any of your stereotyped what women are supposed to look like things. And so this writer, she talks about her experience of being a Sailor Moon groupie when she was young and how the thing that made her the happiest was looking at Sailor Moon costumes online and wanting to order one for herself. But because she was size 16, because she kept having these this sort of self-esteem struggle in terms of this is not for me. People like me are not supposed to dress up that way. And then the article just kind of evolves into how, and this is also the first time I found out that there's such a thing called Disney bounding.
So I've never heard of it before.
Maybe I was so thrilled. So Disney bounding is apparently a huge practice of people who go to Disney World or Disneyland dressed in regular clothes, but that are sort of inspired or are a nod to Disney. So color schemes or themes, because apparently Disney doesn't allow adults to show up in costumes. Again, something that I didn't know. So the article, I mean, it's not life-changing, but then in some ways it is, because you're literally reading about someone's life changing. It goes from a woman who was always self-conscious about her appearance, and because of that, always limited herself in terms of what she would wear, through this journey of how trying Disney bounding and then full-on Disney costumes and attending a costumed event helped her come to terms with the joys of just dressing however she wanted, because it made her happy. And I also love that it had her husband being a part of it, because he seemed like an important part of this journey, and he just sounds like a great guy.
I think it's a story about being good enough. And, yeah. And you know, being good enough for yourself more mm-hmm. than anything else, because she makes it quite clear, I think, that a lot of the pressures that she feels are self-inflicted. She doesn't feel good enough. She doesn't feel thin enough. And of course, that is informed by the world around her. I'm not saying it isn't, but she makes it quite clear that it was a voice in her head mm-hmm. that was that voice that she was trying to silence, or that voice that she was trying to satisfy. And so I really loved that she tied her journey from being a teenage girl wanting to do all these things to being an adult dressed up for Halloween, you know, in Disneyland.
And you get to see the pictures of her outfits as well, which is great.
They were tremendous, yeah. So I super enjoyed it. It was a little slice of joy and delight. And I think if anybody who has had the feeling of not being good enough in their teenage years, which is to say everybody, mm-hmm. I think would be able to get something out of it. But it's bonus points if you like Disney.
Yes. So that is How Conquering the Disney Cosplay Universe Helped Me Finally Love My Body by Tabitha Blankenbiller on narratively.com. So those are our picks of articles that made an impact on us. There are many more, and if you'd like to share some links with us about long reads or interesting nonfiction writing that you've been consuming, you can tweet us at BFM Radio, you can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899, or as always, write to us at buythebook@bfm.my.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.